This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 102, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance, Capital.com, more on that anon, and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Ricky Knox, CEO of Tandon Bank, to talk about whether app-only banks can become real businesses. Ricky has the kind of CV on LinkedIn that leaves me reaching for the happy pills and rather wishing I'd worked harder at school. Peeping through my fingers, I see that inter alia, alia being things like INSEAD, Ricky founded GSM Systems in 2003, where he remains non-executive chairman, which now has partnerships with over 170 mobile operators in 70 countries. In 2005, he formed Small World Services, taking it from inception to a top 10 global money transfer business with nigh on 5 billion annual turnover. Not content with these laurel leaves, he founded the well-known fintech Azimo in 2012, which does remittances to 198 countries globally, has 500,000 customers, and more than 270,000 cash pickup locations worldwide. Okay, you and I would long since have taken the money and run, and be sipping pina coladas on the beaches of the world. Well, actually, I wouldn't, because I didn't like coconut, but somehow I'd find a workaround for that. But not for Nicky. From 2005, he was at Hexagon Partners, the private equity firm. And we still haven't got to today's pertinent incarnation. There must be a gene for Duracell batteries in the mitochondria. In 2015, he founded Tandon Bank, which is where we are today. So I can draw breath, but not without slightly spoiling the story with one fact that some of you folks may know and some of you may not. After decades of decades in this FS lark, I have some little idea of the kinds of juju that are used across the industry. But one of the jujus I've never learnt is the secret private equity art of buying something far bigger than you. A bit like you live in a flat and one day you happen to buy Buckingham Palace. Maybe if the coffee is strong, I'll ask Ricky to break the magic circle's rules and tell us how that trick is done. Ricky didn't buy Buckingham Palace, though there is an old royal connection. But his little startup one day suddenly, from my myriad of perusings, happened, in quotes, to suddenly own Harrods Bank. Now that is some smart juju, and certainly a standout deal in the around 100 fintechs that have been on the show. All of which makes Ricky number one G.I. Joe to talk to us not only just about appy banks, but bricks and mortar banks and where this is all going. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Ricky, thanks for joining me today.
Hi there. Great to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
So, I normally start by asking people what their hobbies are, but clearly your hobby's founding sort of mega businesses roughly every other week, so you probably don't have time for anything else, but you did say that you danced.
Yeah.
And you're a large Scottish gentleman with a sort of orange beard for those people who can't actually see you on the audio.
Yeah, podcast. Technically not Scottish.
So are you nimble on
American,
your toes?
Half American, half English. Yeah, no, I do enjoy various types of dancing from ballroom through to sort of modern dance. But yeah, I dance sober, which is an unusual activity.
It's like bar billiards. The only time I'm ever very good at bar billiards is if I'm completely drunk. If I'm sober, I'm really bad at bar billiards. So how long have you been doing the dancing for?
I enjoyed dancing drunk back in the day when I was younger and managed to find a way to squeeze it in, exercise and enjoying myself, listening to some good music and not getting drunk, which doesn't work quite so well as you move on through life.
Indeed. And given when I was born, I was the kind of sort of generation when there wasn't really dancing. I mean, you shuffle on the disco floor, but I hate discos. Late in the 70s, there was punk, so I could jump up and down.
Yeah.
Although I'm not fit enough to jump up and down too much. So apart from a little bit of swing, that's about it. So, yeah. Of course, I have to ask you about your phenomenal career journey, and I'm sure everybody listening is very interested in the secrets of success, 6 ways to found your unicorn tomorrow, or just sort of more human stuff. So when you were a kid, did you think, oh, one day I want to form loads of companies, or did you just sort of happen to form them by accident as you went along?
No, it's a good question. So, I mean, to be fair, my dad's family are quite a family of entrepreneurs, but in a slightly different way from my career. So my grandfather, my dad's side, founded the Cincinnati Bengals. He was an American football player and then founded a reasonably large American football team. And all of his brothers and sisters did things like, you know, one of them had a massive chain of Burger Kings in California and various other stuff. My dad was a headmaster, so nothing there in the family. But I had always had an idea that entrepreneurship might be an interesting thing. Although, you know, I was growing up at school in the 80s when you know, entrepreneurship was just about moving from a sort of rather sinful and disgusting thing, you know, business and commerce being not that respected, coming out of the post-war years, moving into an era where, you know, people like Branson were starting to make entrepreneurship sexy. And actually, I started my entrepreneurial career in an odd way when my uncle suggested there was this thing called venture capital, which was really going on in Silicon Valley, and I should really try and get myself involved in that.
Which year is this, roughly?
Early 90s. And really, there wasn't much of a venture scene in the UK. So actually, when I started my career, I actually started LEK Consulting, which is a Strat consulting firm, but managed to get myself sent out to San Francisco to find out what was going on in the Valley with all this internet thing that was going on at the time and bring that back for the benefit of some of the large UK corporates and their strategy.
And since then, the internet's somewhat caught on a bit.
It did catch on a little bit. It's an interesting one because we've just been through, in the end of last year, a bubble in blockchain, which a lot of people are drawing parallels to the internet bubble in the late 90s, where suddenly everything was monstrously overvalued. But that's obviously left a bedrock and a legacy that's grown into, you know, some pretty significant businesses today. You know, look at the top 10 largest businesses in the world, and there's just a couple of them that were involved with that little revolution.
Absolutely. So you've got a family background, so you do have the genes, and you were in the right time just as it took off. This is one thing that Jordan Peterson has sort of publicized a little bit in terms of the Pareto distribution.
Yeah.
The Pareto distribution applies to everything from the size of black holes and galaxies to individual wealth, you know, and success across societies. And roughly speaking, to quote his famous phrase, roughly speaking, if you're sort of the middle of it, it's a fairly sort of flat curve and you ain't going anywhere.
Yeah.
If you do badly, it falls off fairly precipitously until you're under an arch drinking meth. But equally, at the other end, if you start to do a little well, you do more well and more. And the further you go up the curve, actually, the theory is, from a social perspective, that, and you can tell me, is that actually it gets easier. You know, it's this saying, your first million is the hardest, et cetera, et cetera. Once you, for example, have founded three absolutely bloody amazing businesses, and then you go and pitch for your fourth, like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
You know, this guy's got the force with him kind of stuff.
That's,
you know,
definitely true. I mean, definitely gets a lot easier. And, you know, in fact, by starting in VC, I was able to get some sort of pattern recognition on what does a business, good business look like? Because, you know, most people obviously aren't really trained in spotting a good business opportunity. And VC is a great sort of school to go and look around and understand and also watch other people make mistakes, which, you know, are a very important part of the learning process. But, and then... You know, I went to INSEAD, which was a wonderful thing to do, but really doesn't necessarily help you with your ability to start businesses.
You learned to write nice essays.
Yeah, exactly. I made a good peer group and set up quite a number of my businesses with that peer group. So, you know, good opportunity to meet people, but yeah, not really going to make an entrepreneur of you. And then started my first business, my brother, which was an opportunity that he'd spotted and had been working in for a time with GSM Systems. And then coming out of that business, I actually went non-executive because I decided to get married to my wife who lives in the UK and that business was based in the US. Started Clarity FX, which you don't actually mention.
Oh dear, sorry, I've missed a few.
No, it's fine. which was a successful but very short-lived business that we sold in 2005, which was a sort of catalyst or gave me the funds to start some of the businesses that I've started since.
Yes, I mean, one point that you made, which was a very good one, that people may have missed, especially the sort of youngsters, the sort of 20-somethings, but I think it applies to all of us, and I think it's a really good attitude to always be learning, no matter how much experience you've got, because the world's always changing and none of us know everything. But the one you mentioned, which is to learn from good people. You know, I get plenty of people pinging me saying, oh, I've got a great idea for a startup, and they think entrepreneur is somebody who goes out there and sort of nails the hole in one, you know, or best chips in from a bunker at the side of the green for two. Whereas, for the sake of argument, let's say I go to Mongolia. Yeah. I'd actually be best advised to learn a little bit about Mongolia first, just to hang out there, see how they do things, how it works, what doesn't work, make connections and all that kind of stuff before I then try and do something there. And in the same way, you know, there are some people who straight out of university manage to create something and it works. But they're a tiny, tiny minority. It's like all these people you see on LinkedIn nonstop saying, oh, Steve Jobs is a great example to me. Steve Jobs is 1 in 7 billion, you know? Maybe you're 2 in 7 billion. But the vast majority of people really benefit by learning something, which is very old school in a way. I mean, when I joined the city, I didn't know anything. And I learned from the elders and betters and then had my own ideas.
And also recognizing your weaknesses and recognizing what you don't know, because it's what you don't know that's going to kill you. But taking the time, I mean, one of the things we were discussing before is, you know, when I enter a new industry, I try and find one person who can describe exactly how the industry works in about 5 minutes. And you find there's remarkably few of those people around. But if you can track them down and learn from them about how the industry dynamics operate, you really, you know, most industries can be described in, you know, in a few paragraphs. But it's amazing how many people, even CEOs, chairmen of large businesses, are utterly unable to see the external perspective on their business. So you've got to seek those people out. You've got to either hire them or work with them and learn from them before you go and dive into a new industry. And I've dived into quite a number of new industries, so important skill.
Yes, talking about dancing and pre-pogoing days, I think it was 1977, the Hawklords album, where Bob Calvert sang, "It's the age of the microman who sees the detail but never the plan." Okay, so you're busy doing all those things, and along with the internet, it all seemed to work out remarkably well. And there is obviously some kind of internal flywheel in your mitochondria or your cells or something, where you don't just go, "Oh, fuck it, I'm going to have some pina coladas." What gets you up in the morning, man?
I have stopped off for pina coladas. Post-ASIMO, I spent a year in Bali before I started Tandem. And actually, technically, Tandem was founded in Bali, where I was in 2014. But we didn't sort of start hiring people back here until a little bit later. But I think from my point of view, it's an interesting one because people are driven by different things. You know, some people are very driven by money, and actually entrepreneurship is basically a bloody difficult way to go out and make money. If you really want to make money, you're actually much better off just going and, you know, becoming a top flight lawyer or a banker in some ways. Not that you can't make a lot more money if you're lucky as an entrepreneur, but bloody hell, it's hard work.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely one of those things where you have to kind of enjoy the game. I remember getting upsetting some investor a lot by describing business as a game, because I think he was feeling that his career had been very much more of a struggle than a game. But I think the idea of winning at the game, understanding the rules a little bit better, being able to rise up above it and see what's actually going on, spot those patterns and act on them without getting too bogged down in the detail, is something that I've always enjoyed and sort of motivates me to go and do other stuff. And more recently, also doing something that drives social benefit as well, makes me feel good about doing what I'm doing. So if you look at the thread through what I did, you know, GSM was bringing some of the first mobile networks to the developing world. Clarity was storing the banks, ripping people off on foreign exchange. Small World was helping make it a lot cheaper to send money home if you're an immigrant and sending money home to the developing world. That's a $5 billion turnover. And then ASIMO, same thing. And at Tandem, we set out to build what we call Good Bank, which is a bank that actually drives benefit for its customers, that actually tries to improve and enrich their lives, which is kind of, I think, a differentiator between us and some of the other guys that are out there. I think everyone's nice and cuddly and uses first names rather than last names, but I think that's certainly, as I progress in my career, increasingly a motivator in what I'm doing.
Yes. Actually, fun enough, I seem to keep quoting Jordan Peterson. I mean, you know, he suddenly had this world tour, his number one Amazon bestseller list, and, you know, sold by the SJWs and all that, but his message of pick up the heaviest boulder you can carry and carry it, yeah, and in doing that, actually, you'll feel better about yourself and you make the world a good place is a way to carry on. And also, I suspect that implicit in actually what you said was something that is associated with pina coladas in my experience of speaking to people over the decades, which is that if you've been very successful at something, and Kevin Keegan springs to mind, one of the England football managers back in the day, he'd been very successful, made a fortune, retired to sort of south of Spain, all that kind of stuff, and then he returns to be England football manager.
Yeah.
And gets loads of slagging by the press, the team's crap as always, you know, it's a bloody nightmare. You know, and somebody at some point said, "What's wrong with you? You know, what on earth will you give up sitting in the sun in Spain on the sun lounger and all that kind of stuff?" But I suspect it's a bit like with you in Bali. There's nothing that sort of recharges your batteries as much as taking some time off.
Yeah, you know,
you feel knackered for a while, you enjoy it for a while, and then you start to feel a bit bored. And then you
absolutely
think, look, I want to do something other than drink pina coladas every day or take more photos or walk up Mount Agungan.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Mountain bike down Mount Agungan generally. But yeah, exactly. But I think that's exactly right.
Which brings us on to this question, whether app banks can actually ever become real businesses, by which perhaps we mean making revenues rather larger than their profits and stuff like that, rather than just doing sexy raises all the time and being nice on social media and all this kind of stuff. And you're well-placed, we'll come into more details of Tandem later, but you're well-placed given that you've got one foot in the sort of bricks and mortar old school banking world and one foot in the we've got a nice app world. So let's just start with a super big picture here. Everybody who listens to the show will, of course, know what app banks are, probably use app banks. I mean, Tom's been on the show, Monzo, Nick from Revolut. What's the big picture at the moment as you see it?
Basically.
And of course, you've stitched yourself up here because you said the ability to see the big picture is a really rare thing. And there are very few people who can do it well.
Yeah, so whether I can, that's another question. The first thing is, if we look at the global banking industry, this is a massive $1 trillion industry. UK revenue pools about $53 billion for retail banking alone. So this is, you know, the largest single industry in the UK. And one of the interesting things is actually, right now, it is not very international. You know, HSBC talks about being the world's local bank, but actually, if you want to open an HSBC account in France when you've got one in the UK, you still have to go through all the KYC as if you were a completely new customer.
It's like a franchise. You sell a McDonald's, it's your McDonald's.
Exactly.
Under a common branding.
So there really isn't, I mean, such a thing as a truly global bank. And I think that's important because I think there is an opportunity. And what you've seen in internet, in you know, companies like Google and Facebook and even the more recent Uber, etc., you've seen this rapid globalization driven by one technology platform that then allows people to export internationally. We talk about sort of there being digital disruption in the banking industry. One of the big opportunities for those digital disruptors is actually to spread out quite quickly and become global banks. And if you look at some of the valuations that have been coming through, they've been looking like they've been pointing that direction. But more on that later. But coming back to where we are in the UK, we've got a very concentrated industry. 86% of the current accounts are owned by the top five players in the UK. And then there is, I mean, there's actually not that many banking licenses out there. I think there are nearly 100. And most of them are owned by Bank of Baroda, you know, the overseas branch of an Indian bank. But there is a tranche of what are being currently called challenger banks, which were really started about 5-10 years ago, with a bunch of private equity banks there to take advantage really of the niches that the banks were leaving behind. So a friend of mine, J.C. Flowers, was talking about their experience in the sector, and he said, absolutely, we have no intention whatsoever of challenging the banks. Yeah, it's a total misnomer. We're attempting to pick up the scraps that they've left behind and do so extremely profitably. So those guys have done well, and they IPO'd all of, you know, £1 billion valuations.
Shawbrook un-IPO'd, didn't it?
Yes, Shawbrook un-IPO'd because Lindsay felt that the markets weren't valuing what she was doing quite highly enough. But, you know, Shawbrook, all the more, One Savings, all did a good job and returned great returns for their investors.
Just in passing, putting this into context, because it is possible to be too internet-y at this stage. Aldermore, Shawbrooks didn't found that long ago, not that much further ago than some of these appy banks, and suddenly they're billion on the stock market. So the old school model isn't as stupid as it looks, because you can create an old school bank and be very successful as they have been.
Yeah, and I think actually they're very much not tech businesses. And I think there's a big differentiation between tech businesses that happen to do banking and old school banks that happen to have tech, and actually put us in the former camp, but more on that in a moment. I think the point is you've got an industry where you've got some very successful, let's call them old style players that are making smart moves. You've got some behemoths that aren't moving very quickly, that are investing a lot in digital and doing some good things, but ultimately are somewhat hamstrung by their size and frankly customer base and technology base, where they've got extremely high cost bases and really struggle to, in some ways, to compete with the nimble, even the nimble Shawbrooks and Aldermores of the world. And you've got a new generation of banks, which really born, I think Atom was 2014, but 2015 and beyond, you know, where the banks at play in the UK are Monzo, Starling, Tandem and Atom. And then there's some non-banks that are sort of claiming the banking throne, like Revolut. And I mean, if you were to widen that out to all prepaid cards, it's about 200 of those guys, but Revolut's clearly the one that's furthest ahead. And then there's, in Europe, there's number 26, which is a very similar model to the Monzo model over here. And so you've got a little cadre of app banks. The interesting thing, of course, is they all have completely different strategies today.
Just pressing pause on that point, I think it is a good overview. I think that switching it over from sort of the background to the foreground, the motivations, as you say, of these players differ quite a lot. I mean, remember, Tom was on the show Christmas before last, and he was quite eloquent at the time about the fact that he was only being a bank, in a sense, because he had to be a bank, and that if he was a bank, it made it very simple, because journalists say, well, oh, we're a bank, you know, that kind of stuff. And he wasn't really a bank for the reasons that I always think of as a bank, i.e. you can create money out of thin air and you can transform maturities and take deposits and mortgages. You know, that's kind of like an old school banker like me sees banking. He more saw it, you know, as personal financial services, point on your phone and da-di-da-di-da-di, wrapped up as being called a bank. Now, subsequently, and I did get taken to task by one or two Monzo fanboys for mentioning this at Christmas, subsequently their development rate hasn't been that great, and so they're pretty much where they were 18 months ago, which is I've still got a nice pink card, which I bought with my coffee with this morning. So you got that perspective, and then I'm not quite sure what Nick's trying to do at Revolut. I mean, it just seems to me he's trying to do everything. So in terms of the motivation, it's very tempting to think, oh, it's a bank. But actually, it's not really. I mean, they're not only coming from different places, they're trying to go in different directions, you know? If I was the fairy godmother and I went along and saw all you five app banks and said, what do you want to be in 10 years' time? Okay, ping, 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 ping. You may find that some of these circles on a Venn diagram don't really overlap very much.
Yep, I'd agree. And I think to take what I'd call probably the biggest outlier first, which is Atom, which is a great business, has built probably by this time $1.5 billion of balance sheet, but very much a traditional bank run by experienced bankers looking to build friendly, I mean, and the guys here are from First Direct, so obviously one of the few banks in the UK that has a very positive net promoter score and is well loved by its customers, and looking to build essentially a digital bank because digital costs less. And I think there's a little bit of a misnomer here, but actually to build essentially a digital building society because they've got mortgages and they've got fixed term savers and they make margin between the two, and not an awful lot of that right now. And they're looking for a very rapid balance sheet build. They've raised a shitload of capital, which is one of their competitive advantages, and, you know, done very well. And I see that business now, it's obviously quite owned in large part by BBVA, I think 39% or something. And so that means that its future is not predestined, but certainly it doesn't have quite as many degrees of freedom in terms of where it goes. But it is, interestingly, it's probably the only one of those businesses I've just mentioned which is not a technology business inherently. And so if you look around at Tandem around here, I mean, we're in a classroom, you guys can't see, but almost everyone here is a developer. So we have 67 people out of 104 involved with product design and development, which is a very different structure from how you'd build a bank if you're building as a banker. You'd be more 70-20 the other way around. So I think Atom is the outlier in not being a technology business.
So if I could summarize, so Atom is a bit like, just simplifying it and caricaturing it, old school bankers who are building an old school bank in the modern world using modern technology.
And yeah, who've said mobile bank.
Yeah.
And they said, that's enough. And our personal view is that in terms of strategic advantage, you know, the mobile interface bit is really only a 2-3 year advantage, because actually the banks are doing a pretty good job of doing much better mobile apps. But the fundamental difference is when you build a technology business, you know, in a normal business, you've got 90% BAU and 10% change. Often there's a little function.
You've got about 90% BS in some as well.
Yeah. Yeah, you get that in tech, definitely, for sure. But yeah, whereas in tech, it tends to be more 90% development and change and 10% BAU. So these businesses are able to move much faster. And you see that, I mean, Revolut's an interesting one because it's probably at the most extreme end of those businesses in terms of being, now admittedly, not burdened down by the inconvenient banking license at the moment, but, you know, of running what's, you know, again, some sort of tech BS, but an agile environment, which means that the teams are independent and capable of building their own little products. So he's got little teams of 8 people
building
separate products. I mean, he says he's doing lots of stuff at once. That's because he's really allowed fiefdoms to develop. And then the only thing they have to do is then combine it back onto the platform at the end of the day.
So let's talk about this combining it back on the platform bit, because I don't think enough has been made of this point. I mean, you've got a phone there, which is befitting slightly larger than my phone. My phone's large enough, but it's not that many square inches. And what it strikes me, and I've never really heard people emphasise it, largely because it's probably in their benefits not to emphasise it, but we all use phones, we all use apps. Some of them are better, some of them are worse, but the ones that are quite nice are relatively simple. They've got a few screens, like the Monzo one does at the moment, and I can do things relatively easily. Now, going back to the first online banks like Intelligent Finance, I've still got an account with. Your computer screen is actually quite big. You can fit more stuff into that without doing my head in and this kind of thing. So what I like your view on is that there's a natural bottleneck, is there not, implied by the visual interface of a few square inches. Going back to Revolut, let's say Nick in a year's time has got 100 teams going, doing 100 products. And there's some poor bastard in the middle who's called Mr. Interface Design, who just loses more and more sleep until one day he's a complete insomniac because he thinks, shit, how can I fit 100 offerings into this without layers of menu and all that kind of stuff? is it not the kind of interface that's going to kind of break down in a non-linear fashion? Like you can do one or two or three or four, maybe five, but you can't bleed and do 99 things on one app.
Yeah. So the answer to your question is two words, service design. So for a great app experience.
I think that's just the label of my question rather than the answer to my question.
Yeah. And you have to design the whole experience that your customer has throughout the app, and you have to do that in a holistic way. And I think the challenge with being, you know, throwing quite as much stuff at the wall that Revolut are doing right now is actually how does that come together as a holistic whole? And it's something Tandem spent an awful lot of time on. The way we do it in our app is we aggregate your information from all of your different bank accounts and your Tandem card, and then we'll analyze that and figure out whether we can see things that might be relevant. Now, that might be that your utility bill's looking higher than it should be, and therefore we can recommend how you could reduce that and a switching journey that takes you to the cheapest utility provider. Or it could be that we spotted duplicate transactions in your account, and actually we want to recommend that maybe you need to contact the bank or us, if it's us, and challenge one of those transactions. It could also be something much more complex, which is, you know, analyzing your cash flow over a period of time. But all those functionalities are buried in what ultimately is a curated version of your own transaction record and only come up. So there is no place currently in our app for you to go and see all the things we do. Some people have criticized that. But, you know, we can right now switch your utility broadband, switch your mobile phones, actually improve your finances in a number of different ways. But we'll only suggest those things when they're contextual and relevant. So we don't actually have to have the real estate to do those things. The real estate comes out of the context.
Yeah, so I take that. And we must come back to the Tandem thing because, you know, these things are very interesting, very sort of value added. It's a good point. I mean, you know, I don't want to use the AI, but computers can do more and more things and they can be clever and they can sort of suggest stuff and all that. But I think the answer is simply that N, where N is the parameter. So for interface design, user design, whatever you want to call it, on a phone, I think if we fast forward 20 years, we will find out that actually, you know, one of the best banking apps, they managed to do 43 things on their phone and people still found it manageable.
Yeah.
But nobody managed more than 43.
Yeah.
So on average, people do 30 or something. So I think there is a parameter there.
No, there's definitely a limit.
This does come back to what we were talking about, which is the motivation for doing it.
Yeah.
If your motivation is, oh, we want to suck all your financial shit into our app, we'll do it for you and we'll help you as much possible. That's great. But actually, there's quite a lot. I mean, I've got pensions, I don't have a mortgage anymore, I might have a mortgage, I've got investments, I've got
yeah.
business account, I've got a personal account, I've got, you know, kids and stuff, and there's all this stuff just floating around, which it would be nice to integrate.
Yeah, and Tandem does allow you to pull almost all of your stuff into one place. Whether we do your business account in one place it doesn't think technically we could, but it's probably not what we're doing. Coming back to the original question, which is how are these guys making money? I mean, if you look through this list right now, Revolut stated that it's making money. I'm not sure what level it is, but Revolut stands on its own. It has a freemium fee-based model, so it is charging per month for the use of the upgraded card. And so you get the basic card for free and you upgrade. So that model, you know, which is essentially charging a fee for a service, a subscription fee, is definitely hitting break even for them. And, you know, I think that model on its own may end up being the prevalent model. We'll have to come and see. I mean, interestingly, Monzo advertised free and always will be free, which I thought was an interesting, and in fact, I was on a panel with him at the time and I said, no, I want to be really clear. Tandem may be free today, but Tandem almost definitely will not be free forever. And so it's an interesting commitment. But both Monzo and Starling run currently what they call a marketplace model, where in theory, you're selling other people's shit on the platform. There's two problems we see with that. The first one is, you know, most of the stuff we sell is switching, so we're finding you the best price.
Yes, exactly.
Whereas they're finding you maybe not the best price, in fact, definitely not the best price. And there's always a temptation in those situations where the price comparison sites suffer from to sell you the worst product that gives them the most commission.
Absolutely. No, I suspect, going back to can they be real businesses, as you say, that the Revolut has got fee for service. Okay, we've got plenty of businesses in the world that do that, and that's sustainable once you get all the parameters right. Perhaps we ought to define what we mean by real businesses, although I did in terms of revenue higher than costs. At the moment, my suspicion is that Monzo will be a very nice target for one of the big five in the UK, because banks spend so much marketing effort acquiring young customers, because then by and large people don't switch and it's a very good value for life. So it's a very likely scenario that they will have created, quotes, a real business for the investors by you stick a quid in. And actually, a few years later, Tom sold it for 10. You go, oh, I made money. It was a real business. But
yeah.
A real business in the sense of somebody bought it for a sum of money.
Yeah, although I think two things I'd lay out against that, and I mean, oddly, not poo-pooing my competition here. And let's talk about Monzo and Starling separately, because one of the interesting things, there are little glimmers in there. Starling is currently making millions of pounds of revenue out of doing payments for the Department of Work and Pensions.
Right.
And a number of other corporates. My view is they're all going to make money. And the reason is because a banking license is a massive gimme. It is a strategic barrier that allows you into an exclusive club where you can raise deposits, coming back to your point, and then rent those out at a margin by lending of any sort. And today, Tandem has a credit card portfolio, a big mortgage portfolio that we bought from Harrods. We're just starting to write our own new mortgages as well, if anyone wants a mortgage who's listening. And we also, we do savings accounts, and we have the app today. But the Monzo and Starling business model only have overdraft and current account, which obviously don't match up to Hill of Beans in terms of actual overall balances. And the thesis was that they're all going to make money through the marketplace. I think, though, both smart entrepreneurs, you know, Starling's already taken advantage of the other exclusive membership you have, which is the opportunity to be part of FPS, the Fast Payment System. And Starling has integrated into that and is reselling its exclusive access to corporates. And in fact, we've chatted to them about even using them to terminate into because we currently use RBS and it's bloody expensive. Monzo's done the same thing. Atom have done the same thing going into that payment system. So that's one way that these things could make money. But if you look at Monzo, already they're moving from where they talked about marketplace and APIs a lot in the beginning, the Starling's executed on, and they're moving away and talking about loans and talking about other categories. So I think you'll find Monzo ends up being a balance sheet business and ends up making money that way, or adds a fee and moves towards Revolut. There was a smart investor I met early on who has actually invested in Atom, so he wasn't that smart. No, I'm sorry. who said, you know, and I said, oh, we're all this is different, that's different, the other's different. He was like, Ricky, if it's really smart and it's working, the others will copy it. Just give them 2 years. And he was absolutely right, you know, and whether that's, you know, Revolut's fee-based model or our balance sheet strategy, you know, I do think people are smart enough to move around.
So in that way, we've got sort of an ecological Darwinian process going on.
Yeah.
You know, people try this niche and that niche. Everyone's looking over the shoulder, everyone else. And
agreed.
And then what's muddying the waters, my prejudice aside, what's muddying the waters is that this process looking over your shoulder and changing your mind is going on at the same time as implementing a strategy, is going on at the same time as some of your developers are working fast and some of them are working slowly.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can have these grand visions, but if your developers are sort of coming in at 10 and going home at 4 in the afternoon and taking long lunch breaks, you don't get much stuff developed.
Yeah.
And you're slightly sort of tacking to that. So you've got all these things swirling around at the same time. So in terms of the list of the app-only banks, you're positive on the sector, which is good and probably necessary if you're in the sector. I think I'm a little bit more sceptical from the outside. I think they're all wonderful businesses. I think they're brilliant experiments, but a bit like you were talking about the interweb in the 1990s, not everything made it alive through the dot-com bubble.
Very true.
And I suspect not every fintech that I've ever met in my life will be around in 10 years' time, whether they just sort of disappeared because they ran out of money and the VCs got fed up of throwing money into the hole, or whether they sold themselves, or whether they're sort of an ongoing business. And then Tandem Bank. Well, let's just start with sort of the first bit. So one day you formed Tandem Bank, or Tandem Money, as it was. It wasn't a bank at the time. And then going back to you're walking past Buckingham Palace and you with your with your shamanic private equity tricks go, I'll have that. And then you sort of kind of got it. And I'm not completely joking because, of course, back in the day, Harrods did actually have a royal license. And
yeah,
certainly in my early days in London, it was a very sort of rurally associated place, but lots of a story there. So anyway, so you're wandering along, you know, with your beard and check shirt, and then you suddenly decide to buy Harrods Bank. So how does that work then?
Yeah, so, well, there's an interesting one. The truth is, you know, and we bought Harrods with equity. And in the same way, I think a number of businesses support larger, more established businesses over time. The market was valuing our equity significantly higher than it was valuing the equity of a loss-making bricks and mortar bank. A little unfair to call to Harrods bricks and mortar because they had one store in sort of the sixth floor of the store. But actually, the business was primarily online savings. And let's be real here. You type something in online and then somebody went and printed it out and typed it into the old-fashioned system. And then the other side manually underwritten mortgages, mostly larger mortgages in central London.
What size of kind of balance sheet or deals were we talking about?
It was about 400 million. It was about 370 of mortgages and about £400 million worth of savings account. But actually underlying a nice business, apart from the fact everything was run manually down to statements and therefore there were hundreds of people running those systems. I think, you know, from a Tandem perspective, first of all, we were lucky in that, you know, our equity was valued more highly than theirs, and therefore we were able to buy it for a minority stake in Tandem. And essentially that business came with a large amount of cash already on the balance sheet, an excess equity that was not being deployed by their current strategy. So we essentially raised money and got a bank with it. We've now migrated all those customers over about 3 weeks ago.
Over onto?
They're onto Tandem Systems. All of them are in, and the migration's essentially complete. We've added back the office. It's not actually in Knightsbridge, it's down in Hammersmith, a couple of weeks ago, and we've integrated a number of their team into the Tandem team and closed the doors of what was Harrods Bank.
So in a sense then, I mean, you're talking about sort of balance sheet-based apps. Are you just, you know, in terms of like snakes and ladder, trying to leap 10 squares up the board by doing it? Because suddenly you require several hundred million of money.
Yeah, that's precisely it. And, you know, we believe, and our belief has always been, that to make money as a bank, you know, the best way to do that is net interest margin. You know, it's a traditionalist view, but
it's worked for centuries.
You have to build a significant balance sheet out of which you make a significant amount of money. Now, obviously, our credit cards make a bit more money on 18.9% rather than, you know, 2-3% on mortgages. And that gives us an opportunity to provide more service to our customers and also to hit break even at a lower balance sheet size. Because if we were talking about the difference between our, let's call it our fixed-term saver, which top rate is 2.3% right now, and our mortgages, which are, you know, at 3% roughly, you know, that's only 70 basis points of margin. You have to have quite a big balance sheet to cover. And almost all of these businesses have 10, 20 million pound cost bases. So, yeah, you know, pretty significant cost base. So to cover that, you need a big balance sheet. But if you then do a bit of basic math and say, well, you know, my card at roughly 18, 19% minus a loss rate, which is low single figures, minus a cost of capital at, you know, 2%, you're making over 10% of net interest margin on that. So to cover a 20 million pound cost base, you don't have to have the most enormous balance sheet when you're making 10% NIM on it. So you can become profitable at quite a, you know, at a 200, 300 million pound balance sheet.
So would it be fair to say, just in sort of simple terms for bears of small brains like me, that you're sort of halfway between the Atomy, more old schooly stuff, and the sort of Monzo-y, Revolut, Starling-y, just pure new world stuff?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I've sort of objected to the description, although I do know what you mean. I think the truth is all of these businesses will need to move to balance sheet if they're going to maintain a banking license. So I'd like to say I'm a step ahead of Monzo and Starling, who will soon realize that they have to increase their balance sheet in order to catch up. But when you look at the other facts, so at a level of customer engagement, and this is a really interesting comparison between Revolut, Monzo and ourselves. So Revolut is at customer engagement running at about, I believe, about 30% of their customers, 35% of their customers are engaging on a monthly basis. Monzo is running at more like 60, 70%. We're running 82% monthly active users. So we've got a much more highly engaged base, which is the sort of digital nirvana that these guys are all looking at. While Atom, you know, they're selling mortgages, the guys probably look at it, you know, at least once a year, whether they need to or not. So I think Atom is in a position, if you were to look at engagement rates, where it's definitely lagging the pack rather than leading the pack.
Right, okay. So just drawing the line a different way then. So if, in this context, we look at Atom more like, shall we say, a Shawbrook or Aldermore that hasn't been successful yet, and it, you know, it's digital friendly, but it's more in that mentality. So let's put them to one side. Then on the sheet of paper, you've really differentiating the main ones of Revolut, Monzo and Starling by how much stuff they're doing at the moment and how much money they're making and that kind of thing. And as you say, that your vision is that all of them, and certainly the hassle of being a bank, as we all know, is considerable, and the cost and the regulatory burden and yada, 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 that if you're going to be a bank, you might as well be a bank, as it were. So you just think that you're further ahead. And I think there's, you know, a strong argument to be made for that. I'm pretty convinced. Right, so we've covered a lot of ground there and very deep insights. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there and my brand partners for the podcast. And it's a very exciting podcast because today I'm introducing a new one, Capital.com. I'll have Ivan Gowan, who's their CEO, on the show soon. He's got an interesting background in terms of coming from 15 years at IG Index, who are absolutely massive over here, where he ran hundreds of people. And it just occurred to me this morning, in a sense, that Capital.com, who've got a trading platform and an app to allow you to trade, are in a sense the ultimate disintermediators in the market they're in that they cut out completely, as it were, investment management, because you can just do your trading directly. Anyway, more about them anon. And there's also a huge flag to wave for Blue Motor Finance, who in the recent 2018 FT 1000 turn out to be the 21st fastest growing business in Europe, the fastest financial services growing, and the second fintech. And don't ask me the difference between financial services and fintech. So anyway, they're all doing absolutely amazing, which makes me very pleased. So, Blue Motor Finance are, according to the 2018 FT 1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe, Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending to over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Capital.com, making CFD trading more accessible and engaging in 23 languages. 500,000 downloads in 51 countries. Check out Capital.com or download the app. Trading is risky. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So, Ricky, you mentioned sort of many, many things that your tandem does for people. So if a listener out there, I assume it's just UK listeners at the moment?
It is, just for now.
Okay, so people, what is in the UK, go to Tandem and get one of things. What do they actually get and what can they do with it and why should they?
So tandem.co.uk is our website, the app and card, and ideally get both. You can get them both on our website. Obviously, download the app in the App Store. The app allows you to bring in all your different accounts and analyzes them, helps you optimize your finances. So you can link your Barclays or Lloyds or HSBC or pension into that interface, and it allows you to see everything in one place, but also uses algorithms to drive out insights from that, how you can save money, reduce your bills, put your money in a better place. So if you've got your money suboptimally allocated, it'll spot that. And it's best use the card, because if you get the Tandem card, it's a credit card, which is different from some of the other players. We deliberately think you shouldn't be replacing your current account right now with this. You should get this as an addition and aggregate your account into the system. And the card is a brilliant card if you're going on holiday, planning to spend any time outside the UK. It's 0.5% cash back, so you get paid on cash back wherever you are, but it's also got no FX fees, no ATM withdrawal fees abroad. So unlike Revolut and Monzo, which will charge over £200,
yes,
you should get one. So
yes, I noticed that.
It's unlimited from our perspective. So if you're going abroad, great card to use at home and abroad, but a great complement to your existing financial services portfolio.
Right, so we've covered lots of stuff, and you do all sorts of things there. And as I'm trying to give up coffee because it's making me insomnia, my brain's sort of overloaded. What's the kind of summary? What's the vision of what you're trying to do for the people? As you said at the beginning, one of your motivations for getting out of bed in the morning, continuing to be a super entrepreneur, is actually to make the world a little bit of a better place. So what are you actually trying to do for your users in that context?
So Tandem is the good bank that aims to make its users life rich. That means that you can have an easier life and let the money get out of the way.
Oh, that sounds good. I like easier life. I also like money flowing in as well. If you can help me with that, we'll definitely have a conversation later on.
We do that too.
Oh, excellent. So where are you going in the future? And what do you need in terms of partners or people in Bali or that? in terms of throwing breadcrumbs up on the water, please tell my wonderful
definitely.
Listeners.
So, I mean, first of all, we're saying that Tandem does operate a marketplace and is really happy to partner with anybody else who wants to access our growing customer base. And in addition, always happy to receive more retail customers. Would love everyone to give it a go and sign up.
Excellent. That sounds fantastic. Well, I can mention Jordan Peterson because he's on my mind today. Bridget's just finished reading his book, so I've got to start reading it now. I mean, one of the things that he said is goes along with success is just working very hard, which people always underestimate, and lazy people like me try and avoid. And then I wonder why I'm busking at sort of Bank Underground rather than living in a marble tower. But clearly, you've put a lot into this, and as you demonstrate, just knowing a hell of a lot about the industry you're in and thinking about it a lot is also really useful. And I didn't know much about Tandem Bank personally before, so you know, apart from everybody else, I was really interested to hear where you are. And I like the topology and, as I say, I think I'd probably have to sort of question my own question in the first place about, you know, what's real business. But I think all of these app banks have done something really interesting and really impressive so far in a very short period of time. And I think it's going to be a really interesting story, and I'm sure it'll all look very different in 5 years. So thank you for giving us the overview of where we are and where it's going. And I wish you every success in the future.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. We are wild like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.